Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economics think tank. My name is Katja Knežević, I am Bruegel's head of communications, and today I am joined by Maria de Mertes, Bruegel's senior fellow and former deputy director. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Katja. Thanks for having me.
After 8 extraordinary years in Bruegel, Maria is leaving us for greener pastures. Not that there is such a thing when it comes to Bruegel.
Exactly. To
take up a new position at the conference board. Firstly, congratulations, Maria.
Thank you so much, Katja.
She has kindly agreed to sit down with me today to look at the past 8 years and to do a sort of an inventory of crises, quote unquote. It's not as grim as it sounds, I promise. These are Maria and Bruegel we are talking about. So for every crisis, there's a solution. So let's dive in. Maria, you joined us at a peculiar period in the world and EU history, the infamous 2016. So the first Trump election, Brexit. What first comes to mind when you think about that year and the memories of joining Bruegel?
Yeah, indeed. In fact, I joined in June of 2016. That was the famous referendum, of course, in the UK. And by the time I joined, I think it was becoming increasingly obvious that things were not going to go the way that we thought they were going to go. And yeah, one of my first memories is being underneath the commission buildings on the day after the referendum. And I remember distinctively icicles dropping from the commission Berlin Mond, where people were totally shocked with the outcome of the referendum, even though I think by that time, I think it was becoming increasingly obvious. But still, it was a disbelief across the board. And there was a lot of journalists, of course, underneath the Berlin Mond. And I remember sort of talking about what happens next. Nobody knew what was going to happen next. And it was, I mean, in the history of the EU, it was really a shocking moment. The country had consciously decided to exit the EU, right? I mean, if you think about it, it is a very big event in the context of EU history. So it had always been a constructive project where, you know, countries join in. We had never had this idea that a country will consciously leave. And this is what we've been confronted on that day. And it was really memorable. And of course, we are 8 years later, the UK has left the EU. It hasn't turned out, in my view, as rosy as they hoped it was. They thought it might turn out. But the end also, it hasn't been the end of history either. The world hasn't collapsed as a result of that. It's important to also understand that these things, can happen. And, you know, we should try and remain constructive when it comes to the way that narratives are being discussed. I think it's important to reflect on that as well. I mean, my view is that the UK will come back at some point into the EU because, first of all, it belongs there and it's better for it and the EU is better for it. But in any case, politics is what it is, and it got us here. So I think that was perhaps one of the most memorable moments. And indeed, it was my first experience with Bruegel, so it was really quite memorable.
Exactly. Actually, I want to stay in the mood that you just set there, because you joined in 2016, you're leaving now in 2024. There's a certain symmetry, because halfway through in 2020, there was another unprecedented crisis. Yeah. And like Brexit is, so the COVID pandemic has also proved as kind of a gigantic challenge that opened up a number of opportunities. The main difference, obviously, being the first one was man-made, the second one more a natural disaster type. But I do remember also that Brexit period and the sense of disbelief, you know, the inability to say something, the inability to breathe even.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, actually. Yeah.
And you painted a lovely picture as well. Do you have an image like that for 2020 when the earthquake of the pandemic happened?
Oh, yeah. In some ways, it was even more kind of distinct. It was a Friday. I don't remember the date exactly. So it must have been either the end of February or beginning of March. And what had happened is that the French had closed schools. And I remember we had come to Bruegel, and we knew that something like this was going to come to Belgium as well. In fact, it did happen on that Friday evening. Belgium also closed schools. So I remember being at Bruegel, and we were saying, well, what thing is going to happen? So, you know, in the context of management, we were thinking, oh, how do we prepare for something like this? And, you know, what do we do? And what we had agreed on that day is that we should perhaps take our screens with us, because maybe we needed to stay for weeks at home. And what's shocking about that is that we did have to stay at home many, many weeks. And the first time we saw each other again physically after that was in September of 2020. So here we are. That was actually pretty shocking. And I know we've been through it now and we almost have forgotten it. But if when you look back, I think it was just as shocking, the fact that you wouldn't see your colleagues physically for another 6 months.
Yeah, there was a sense of blinding shock, I would say. I think from both of these shocks that we just mentioned and then others that we haven't yet, it does feel like we're still reeling from it. And I often feel like Bruegel's work is a kind of an anchor that keeps us going, because we know that we are, you know, looking for solutions. And basically, on that note, I do want to talk about your work at Bruegel. So when you first joined us, one of your first papers at the time was on inflation, a topic that you will inevitably keep coming back over the 8 years, especially given your experience as a central banker. So can you tell me a bit more about, what are your thoughts on how inflation rates in the euro area fluctuated? Have the attempts at controlling them worked? How have they worked, and why haven't they, if they haven't?
Yeah, so I came to Bruegel from a central bank, via the commission, actually. But I had been a central banker for a very long time, working on big issues on that have to do with monetary policy and inflation, as you say. And indeed, one of the first things I wrote at Bruegel, you're quite right, was on the newly created asset purchase program. It was a new instrument that after the financial crisis, other countries tried first, and then the EU also tried, so the ECB. And so we wrote a little piece on the asset purchase program and the effects of the asset purchase program, the way that we understood them back then. This is a topic that, because it's very new, we are still learning about it. And in the context of research, it takes decades before our thoughts are crystallized in terms of the mechanisms through which these new instruments feed into the economy. Of course, at the time, we were talking about an era where inflation was not a problem. If anything, we had the opposite problem of what do we deal with the absence of inflation and very low interest rates, which in itself creates a few problems. Now in 2024, we're in a very different position. Of course, we had been through the energy shock, yet another shock in the context of my history at Bruegel. And now, although inflation rates are still kind of there, they're much, much lower than where they were 2 years ago, right? But it's interesting that the topic of inflation is kind of come back. And what do we think about it and how do we deal with this? But it was also a very specific type of inflation, right? It was the type of inflation that policy couldn't really influence, at least at the beginning of the shock. It happened because of energy prices. It had a very specific reason why it emerged, and there wasn't much you could do. What you could do is prevent the secondary effects. So after inflation, things then go into a more of a spiral form, and that you can do something about. And indeed, the ECB intervened to try and remove this, what we call the second order effects. We are still have a few lagging things when it comes to inflation. There are certain countries that have got specific items of food that are still very, very expensive, and they certainly perceive to be very expensive. There is a difference between actual prices and the way you perceive inflation, which is an interesting psychological difference. But they are persistent and therefore affecting the consumer basket in a particular way, and it's very, very present in the minds of the consumers. Yet a different type of inflation that generations of researchers will have to look at, and that includes myself, in the conference board and elsewhere.
Exactly. I really like the two axes that you're raising here when talking about this issue. The first one being how you're hinting at the fact that the external shocks sometimes even test the limits of the field of economics. Our director is very much into, you know, empirical economics. You know, economics is in everything, and every so often there's an external shock that tests the frontiers of the field and see how far we can push them. And oftentimes the farthest that we can go is like, okay, let's just collect lessons and do better next time. And I feel like we've done that a lot. And the second thing that you're hinting at is your natural sense of empathy that you fall into spontaneously without even thinking about
it.
So
you
start talking about inflation and you switch to talking about people and how it affects them, and how even the psychology mixes in with economics.
If I may say something on this, Katya, I mean, I came into economics because I cared about people. Yeah, for me, there isn't such a thing as a distinction between theoretical economics and empirical economics. There's only one thing, and that's empirical. Economics isn't a theoretical science. Economics is about how do we make things better for people on when it comes to sort of managing finances. Effectively, that's what it is. So I have never really understood what people meant when they said I'm a theoretical economist. You could be a theoretical physicist, but a theoretical economist, you can use theoretical tools, but you're trying to still answer empirical questions, things that can affect us in real time, isn't just for generations in the future. It's about understanding problems that we have now. And this is why I was drawn into Bruegel. I think Bruegel does that very well. academically very strong, skilled people, but with a great eye and ear for policy questions. I mean, so try to answer questions that are now of relevance. So that, I think, is important to reflect, because it's also pinpoints the strength of Bruegel.
Yeah, exactly. I think you put that beautifully. And speaking of use of theoretical concept, in your first 2 years at Bruegel, your work was more classically macroeconomic, but following a certain sense of symmetry that we are touching upon around 2018. So 2 years in your experience at Bruegel and 2 years before the pandemic would hit, I would say your interest crystallized into two unique streams. One of them being the productivity of firms, and then, of course, financial literacy.
Ah, yes.
The latter has become somewhat of your signature area and one of my personal favorite parts of your legacy. So nice. Can you tell us more?
Sure. So let me say a little bit about the first, because I wanted to also publicize the work that we did. We had a European Commission grant on working exactly on this. And I'm very proud of that program because it ended up being one of the best programs that the Commission had run, they told us. And it is very much about productivity. And I raise this because in the years ahead, one of the problems that the European Union will have to tackle is exactly this, productivity. How do we become more productive? There is a productivity gap between the EU and other parts of the world. And the policy agenda in the next few years is going to be very much about that. So we had a few things there, which we actually used even during the context of the pandemic to try sort of say there's switches that happened during the pandemic that was unexpected. So I was very happy with the collaboration between a number of universities and Bruegel and the type of research that we produced back there. And then, of course, financial literacy. It's interesting that I have followed the topic of financial literacy as soon as I joined the central bank, because I remember very distinctively, first of all, I met the people who did the research on financial literacy. And here I have to mention the Professor Luzzardi, who is really one of the biggest experts on the subject. And I met her very early on in my years at the Central Bank. And I will remember thinking, even though I wasn't active myself on doing research on financial literacy, I remember thinking, wow, this is one of the biggest tools in terms of preparing people again on dealing with financial aspects of the daily lives. So I had followed her research very closely, and when I came here to Bruegel, I saw an opportunity to what I would call is bring the topic of financial literacy to Brussels. I remember at the time the European institutions weren't particularly keen on thinking about this, because you think about financial literacy, you think about education. Education typically is a national competence. But actually, it's not correct to think in those terms because Brussels is the supervisor, the regulator of big financial institutions. And therefore, if financial literacy is a tool for more robust financial resilience, then Brussels should be interested. That was my thinking. And I did want to sort of make this point. And then I hooked up with Professor Luzzardi again. Over the years, we have done a few things on this issue and on financial literacy and financial fragility. And in fact, it helped me also produce one of my best op-eds, best in the sense the ones I enjoy writing the most. It was a little op-ed I wrote on exactly on this topic with a fantastic title of The Fearless Girl. This was a title that Anna Maria, actually, Professor Luzzardi, is the one who had used in her presentations. And it is an icon of a little girl in front of New York, the Stock Exchange.
The Wall Street statue.
The Wall Street statue, indeed. And it actually pinpoints the, if you like, the contradiction between the Wall Street, which is a monster, a bull, in fact, and then a little girl that is fearless and sitting there. You can see the metaphor in many different levels. And I wrote a little op-ed about that fearless girl. And it was an op-ed about the gender gap in financial literacy, mm-hmm. which we know exists.
Yes, yes.
And yeah, it was, again, it reflects my sort of deep belief in the role of financial literacy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's I'm very happy to see it's one of the topics that has really become more mainstream, specifically, yeah. You know, women investing, female financial education, etc. So I'm happy that you contributed to that.
And in fact, Brussels is now very interested in this. And I'm yeah. delighted that the fact that it's become one of the tools, as indeed it should be, of thinking about financial resilience for all of us, and particularly for the consumer.
Yeah, exactly. And going into that field has prudent investment on your part, because finally, earlier this year, the Belgian presidency actually commissioned a paper that you co-authored with Professor Luzzardi on the state of financial knowledge in the EU. And you had the honor to present it at the informal ECOFIN.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us how that experience went?
Yeah, first of all, it was really a vindication, right, of the fact that, you know, finance ministers should really be interested on financial literacy. Mm-hmm. And you know, my gratitude to the Belgian presidency for making it very concretely this way. And it was really great. It is the motivation for putting it in the agenda is very much the need for advancing on capital markets. So we want people to invest differently. We want people to move away from banks and invest in capital markets. But they care. Without financial literacy, this could go wrong in very many different ways. And indeed, that is exactly what the Belgian presidency wanted to point out. And there we used a new survey that the European Commission has done on the state of financial literacy. There are many surveys on financial literacy done at different levels, but this was the first one that was done in a similar way across all EU countries, and therefore it allows us to compare between countries.
Yeah, it has a consistency of methodology that was needed.
Indeed. And therefore we could compare and contrast. And it was really quite disappointing to see that it's only just about one in two people in the EU. The EU being a rich continent is considered to be financial literate. So there is still a lot of work to be done on this level, which is good for me and good for Professor Luzzardi, but not so good for for our audience. I mean, we need to advance in financial literacy, but now there's so many activities in this respect everywhere, and all countries have some sort of a financial literacy strategy. And I also have the honor to be in the advisory committee for the financial literacy strategy in Cyprus, which is something where you can also see it implemented from zero all the way to the schools, but also adult education.
Yeah, exactly. It's missing this formal element. The topic is gaining traction more, you know, on social media in kind of these kind of free-flowing mainstream culture, but maybe it's missing the formal elements.
But we get it there, and that's very nice to see.
Yeah, and it must feel nice to have contributed to that.
Absolutely.
So let's talk favorites, because you mentioned that Fearless Girl was your favorite op-ed to pen.
Yeah.
So having worked at Bruegel, we have a number of editorial outputs that allow our researchers to really, you know, crack their knuckles and see how they can express their thoughts in different ways targeted at different audiences. Mm. So from the long reads through analyses to the op-eds and glances. So can you pick, just at random, a couple of favorites that you really enjoyed writing and tell us why?
Yeah, of course. Now, first of all, it's important to perhaps let our audience understand why we have different types of editorials, outputs at the Bruegel. So the op-eds really are your opinion, yeah? It's an opinion. It's not necessarily the truth. It's what you think about a certain topic. But the rest of our outputs, whether they are small pieces, the analysis, or they are bigger pieces, the what we call the policy briefs, they are an attempt, and a very sincere attempt, to be objective. Yeah, they're not so much about what is your opinion about something. It's about here are the facts, here's some data, here's an analysis of this data, and this is what it leads to. And at the end of it, we also make policy recommendations. And that has been a very nice way of differentiating between products. If you want to write an opinion about something, well, you write an opinion piece. But for the rest, you've got to remain objective. And this is absolutely essential for an institution like Bruegel. At least you need to attempt to remain objective, right? So when it comes now to the types of works that I've done, apart from The Fearless Girl, which was an op-ed, there were two pieces that I would pick that I really enjoyed writing because they were extremely timely and I learned very much when I was writing them. First, I wrote a small blog, what we now call an analysis, after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I wrote a little piece with Francesco Pavadia, which I incredibly enjoyed writing it because I learned what it meant. And it had to do with the question, why did Putin ask Europe to pay for oil and gas in rubles? Yeah, the energy contracts that we had with them were in euros or in dollars, mostly in euros. And yet we had to buy rubles and pay in rubles. And the question is why? Why did we have to do that? And of course, it has to do with settlement. For if we pay in euros and Putin has to access those euros, he couldn't because he was under sanctions. And therefore, the settlement system, which happens at the European Central Bank, wouldn't be able to carry this transaction, which meant that Putin didn't have access to the euros that Europeans were paying for energy. Now, it seems very obvious now, but at the time it didn't, because the European Union didn't have much experience with imposing sanctions. So all the secondary effects of sanctions weren't immediately obvious. At least they were not obvious to us. And I remember there was a huge demand for understanding this. And in fact, after we wrote the blog, I wrote a little thread in Twitter, which had something like a million impressions, simply because that was the thirst for people to try and understand why on earth was this happening. So what I liked about that is how relevant it was. Anyways, the fact that I invested together with Francesco, and he was very knowledgeable on the subject, investing time to understand why this had happened was something that really was demanded out there from the public. So that was something I really enjoyed. And then the longer piece that I enjoyed, I mean, there were many, many pieces that we had written for the informal ECFIN. They were always fun to do. But one piece that I enjoyed writing very much, again, because I learned so much in the process of writing it, it was a piece that I wrote last year only, or maybe it was a little bit earlier than that, with an array, a very competent array called Katarina Martins, who is now doing a PhD in Sweden. It was about the digital euro. We had worked on the digital euros before that and after that, but this was the piece where we did all the research and tried to understand the whys and the hows. So the one on the digital euro then on the longer pieces was perhaps...
Remember we also had the follow-up events about how different digital currencies works in our places exploring the limits of what we currently have at our hands. And I think the topic also links to the wider umbrella of financial fragility that you're always keep going back
sure.
to. Okay, speaking of publications, I really want to talk about the memos.
Yes.
Tis the season, as they say, so... The president's memo and the higher-up memo have been out for 2 months now. The remaining 18 are going to be launched next week at the Bruegel annual meetings.
Yeah.
You have been part of this process twice already, because every time when there's a change of the EU leadership, Bruegel steps up and steps in to give some recommendations. So it was in 2019 and now in 2024. Tell us about the process, because you've been on the senior editorial team, basically, for both publications.
Yeah.
In practice, just to explain to our listeners, that means that you authored or co-author a couple of memos, but you do have to go through all of them and suggest improvements and kind of consolidate the publication. So tell us about the process, please.
Yeah, so the process is exactly this. This is where we really dig into our fellows' expertise to try and write concrete recommendations as to what the new leadership in Brussels at the EU institutions should really worry about. And I mean, what's nice about this process is, first of all, you really tap. It's the first time that you have a pool of knowledge and you really tap on them. And I think the difficulty with writing the memos is the discipline to remain very concrete. And both times we had the same format where we start by saying, okay, what is the problem here? What are the challenges here? Where are we? What is the state of affairs, if you like? What are the challenges that we're facing? What should we do about them, right? These are, if you like, these three legs into a stool. And we followed that last time and we followed it again this time. And the discipline to talk about the state of affairs when we talk about the state of affairs and not talk about the challenges when you talk about the state of affairs is not an easy thing. And actually, you have here very knowledgeable people, and try to discipline everybody to stay in these three different steps is actually part of the difficulty. But if you do follow it, it pays out tremendously, because it's very clear. This is where you are. These are the problems you will face. And this is what we think you should do.
Yeah.
And in fact, by the end of the process, we always get there, because the editorial comes in with that angle. Please stay with these three different concrete steps. And really, the audience would judge the quality of this. But I really do think that by the time we get to the recommendations, we are very, very concrete as a result. And this is where I think the strength is, and where the contribution of Bruegel can be in preparing not only the new leadership, but also the public in thinking about what happens ahead. And it's very enjoyable, because, the plethora of expertise at Bruegel really is quite impressive. Every time you see how much knowledge there is around the topics that Bruegel works on. And it's actually an absolute pleasure to read all of it, and an honor to comment on people's work.
I think the sophisticated nature of the process and how much people enjoy participating in it is absolutely reflected in the results. I'm not an economist myself, but my background is in languages and my expertise in communication. So the seeing people get on the same page about something, kind of meet in the language, in the abstract, is to me that's a goal in itself. I put a tick sign next to that already, and then see it in, obviously materialize into these robust recommendations.
And remember that we have to do it within 3,000 words, and that's another limit that is extremely, extremely useful in my view. You have to say whatever it is you have to say within 3,000 words. So the level of detail you can get in is defined by the number of words, right? We cannot have big 10,000-word, 20,000-words type of essays. We need 3,000 words.
No, of course, because you need to be specific and it needs to, you know, want to send a clear message, but you also want the people reading it to consume it in a way that's clear to them and that provides certainty. I would say that the constraints are what leads to certainty and kind of clarity of vision. I'm a big fan of rules. I like boundaries. I like limitations. If I may mix in poetry with economics, it was Charles Baudelaire that said in an essay, or I think it was a prose poem even, that he perceives more of the sky between the limitations of two chimneys than having an open field of the horizon. And I always...
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I remember reading that when I was doing an essay on him back in uni, and that's I always kind of stuck with that, you know, the mythical horror of the blank page. It's easier when you start with limitations. Okay, this is my playing field. I have 3,000 words. What's the most important thing people need to know and do? Here I go. It's a joy to watch it come to fruition in Bruegel with the memos.
I wanted to maybe add, because as you said, Katya, I was involved in the previous memos, and so the span of my time here at Bruegel, I had to do it twice. And, you know, we wrote the previous memos in 2019, yeah? Knowing now what had happened after 2019, we had the pandemic, we had the energy crisis. So, you know, I went back and looked at the memos and, were we right? Were we wrong? I mean, we were incredibly prophetic in some peculiar way, but I think it's important to reflect today on the fact that we had no idea what was going to come. Yeah, the pandemic and then the energy crisis, the war in our borders. We had no idea in 2019. And I think it's important, here we are embarking again on the same process for the next 5 years. We have no idea what's going to come. Yeah, and that's, we need to think about resilience. Yeah, we need to be prepared for the unprepared. Yeah, and how do you prepare for something like that? How do you prepare for a pandemic crisis or God knows what crisis will come? And having done it twice, this is what I think it's the most important one. So be prepared for the unprepared, that, you know, what's going to happen next 5 years could be very different to whatever we write in the memos or to whatever we think now is possible. And I think that's resilience is going to be the one word we have to really bang on. Anything on policy, it has to be policy that can do well enough in a big variety of circumstances, because we just simply do not know what the circumstances are going to be, and we cannot be caught off guard. Of course, we have the time to react, like we did with the pandemic. We had things we could do, and that. But you know, making sure that there are options out there, if and when shocks hit us, to react and to find the strength and the money and the willingness to actually deal with the shocks as they hit us.
Okay, you're heading naturally in a direction that I wanted to head as well, which is based on the experiences that you've had over the last 8 years, what cautious predictions you would be able to make.
Exactly.
As mentioned at the beginning, there's a certain symmetry to your time at Bruegel. So there's this something big happening every 2 years or every 4 years, depending how you turn around the Tesseract. So there were, you know, the big tsunamis of 2016 and Brexit, 2020 and the pandemic, 2022 and the invasion of Ukraine and the energy crisis. So 2024 has not had this one, maybe big earthquakes as much as many fractures, but there's still a lot to draw comparisons. And based on that, and based on both, you know, the two memo processes, all the publications, all the problems that you've had the opportunity to look at, what do you think are the biggest challenges ahead? I know you said we have to prepare for the unexpected. And obviously, we're not going to go back to listen to this in 5 years' time, or maybe we will, to see if you... So there's no pressure of
getting... Accountability.
Yeah, of getting it right. You know, you're an economist, you're not a tarot reader. But tell us what you think from, you know, from where we are right now, what we've had to adapt to and learn about in the past 5 or 8 years, depending on how you look at it. What do you think will be the next big challenges for Europe? You mentioned resilience, you mentioned uncertainty, vulnerability, all what's behind these rather abstract notions. And then as a follow-up, I'd be interested in what you'd recommend.
Oh, yeah. So while, I mean, you know, I'm very cautious to make predictions, as for the reasons I explained, we are knowledgeable. It's not that we don't know anything. We don't go, we're not walking sort of in the dark here. There is things we do know. And so one of the things that we know is that the world today is a lot more fragmented than it was in 2019. And that brings problems by itself. Of course, we have a war that in our borders, and we don't know when and how this will end. Obviously, the quicker the better, but we don't see the end, at least not now. We have a rising power in China that is claiming, I'm not going to say a leadership position, but it is claiming a place in the world arena that is different than what it was previously. And therefore, the natural leaders, which primarily the US and then the EU, have to step back to allow for some space in China. What tectonic movements that will bring is not so obvious, but there is a shift there in terms of who is the supreme leader in the context of the global economy. We have the crisis of the climate that needs to be addressed, and that is my biggest worry, because you cannot solve climate unless you do it with everybody. And yet the world is being fragmented. So we are moving in opposite direction of exactly what we ought to be doing to solve the biggest crisis, which is climate, and it affects us all. It's not that it affects one part of the world only. So these are things we do know. Now, in terms of the shocks that will hit us, I mean, you know, we're going to have elections in the US in November, and it's probably going to end up having President Trump coming back. I mean, this is now looking increasingly likely. We don't know, but that is not going to help solve the war. At least it's not going to help the European position when it comes to what the war should end. Even despite the rhetoric that is coming out of the Republican Party is one of we have to end the war immediately, but we'll see about that. So there are difficulties ahead. And of course, politics, we've seen the rise of the extreme right in Europe in ways that we hadn't seen in many years. That's not helpful because, again, it adds to fragmentation. So we're moving in some ways in the wrong way that we ought to, even within the EU, but also outside in the global world. We have to cooperate more, and yet all the forces are doing exactly the opposite. Fragmentation, less cooperation, inward looking.
Okay, but what are some things that give you hope?
You know, human nature will react to disaster, you know? Mm-hmm. If you have a small heart attack, you quit smoking. I just hope it is a small heart attack, not a big one, because that will be the end of it. So human nature reacts, and but it needs shocks and it needs to be sort of moving. So it's hopeful because that means we will adjust. It's just that I don't know how far we need to go into that size of the heart attack before we actually do the right thing. This is the difficult part. But we will react. Human nature is not the one that naturally suicides. Yeah, we will not do that. Mm-hmm. But we will pay a price for it. And the question is how big that price is. So I think it is hopeful. I would have liked it to be better so we can, we know it's coming. For example, the climate issue. Why don't we do it now? Why don't we solve it now globally? And why don't we cooperate for it? That's much more difficult. And this is why the problems come in exactly this point.
Yeah, yeah. And you're picking up on a very important message that Bruegel is sending out this autumn. You know, the title of our memo collection is Unite, Defend, Grow. So there's a strong narrative of, you know, needing to stick together, getting on the same page if we want to circle back to linguistics.
Absolutely. And the unite is the most important one in my view, because this is the bit that, I mean, the European Union is not always united. It can be, and it has been. We've seen it also in the pandemic. It came together immediately, pulled the money together, created a program, dealt with the issue. Less so in the energy crisis, but eventually we got there. But I mean, that's exactly what we need. We need to be united on the big things. And you know, why can't we just agree on this? Why do we need to wait for a shock to be united?
Yeah.
This is the difficulty, and much more so in the global level.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. Okay, Maria, I think we can close on this hopeful note.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
And for the last 8 years. It has been an honor in every way.
Thank you, Katja. Thank you so much. It's been absolutely wonderful being here. And of course, I will continue to be a big admirer of Bruegel.
Thank you. And thank you to our listeners of the Sound of Economics podcast. Join us next week for the Bruegel annual meetings, either in person or via the live stream. And stay tuned for the next episodes of our podcast channel. Goodbye.